Tawny Owl gave a slight cough, content. A decent band, he thought. Ah, well, were it not for official policy. Ah, to assemble a Hansa like that and head for the marches, to plunder, rape, murder and burn, a man would feel young again. Pshaw, if it weren't for politics. Well, Sir Stefan? Dacre Siliphant asked, flushing with barely concealed excitement. How do you find them, these splendid sparrowhawks of mine? Tawny Owl's eyes travelled from face to face, from figure to figure. He knew some of them personally, for better or worse. Others, whose acquaintance he was now making, he had heard of, by reputation. Till Echrada, a fair-haired elf, a scout of the Jemerian pacifiers. Rispat Lapointe, a sergeant from the same unit. Next, a Jemerian. Cyprian Fripp, the younger. Skellen had been present at the execution of Fripp the Older. Both brothers had been famous for their sadistic proclivities. Further away, leaning back easily in the saddle of a piebald mare, was Chloe Stitz, thief, occasionally hired and utilised by the Secret Service. Tawny Owl's eyes swiftly darted away from her insolent gaze and nasty smile. Andres Vieni, a Nordling from Redania, a vicious killer. Stigwood, a pirate, a renegade from Skellige. Didi Vargas, an assassin by profession. The devil only knew where he was from. Cabernic Tourant, a murderer by vocation. And others, much the same. They're all akin, Skellen thought. A guild, a fraternity, where, after killing the first five people, they all become the same. The same movements, the same gestures, the same manner of speech, of movement and dress. The same eyes, impassive and cool, flat and immobile like the eyes of a snake, whose expression, nothing, not even the most monstrous atrocity, was capable of changing. Well, Sir Stefan?
Not bad. A decent Hansa, Siliphant.
Dacre blushed even more and saluted in the Jemerian fashion, fist pressed against his kalpak.
I especially requested, Skellen reminded him, several people who were no strangers to magic, who fear neither spells nor sorcerers.
I remembered. Why, there's Tillichrader. And apart from him, see that tall maiden on that splendid chestnut, the one beside Chloe Stitz.
Bring her to me later.
Tawny Owl leaned on the balustrade and rapped on it with the metal-tipped handle of his knout.
Hail, company! Hail, Lord Coroner!
Many of you, Skellen began, when the echo of the gang's combined roar had died away, have worked with me before, know me and my requirements. Let them explain to those who don't know me what I expect from my subordinates and what I do not tolerate from them. Then I shan't waste my breath needlessly. This very day, some of you will receive your assignments and will ride out at dawn to execute them. In Ebbing. I remind you that Ebbing is an autonomous kingdom, and we have no formal jurisdiction there. So I order you to act prudently and discreetly. You remain in the Imperial service, but I forbid you from flaunting it, boasting about it, or treating the local rulers arrogantly. You shall behave so as not to attract attention. Is that clear?
Yes, sir, Lord Coroner.
Here in Rockane, you are guests and ought to behave like guests. I forbid you from leaving your assigned quarters without an essential need. I forbid you from making contact with the fort's garrison. The officers will think up something so that boredom doesn't drive you to fury. Mr. Harsheim, Mr. Brigden, please show the troop their quarters.
I'd barely managed to get off my mare, Your Honour, than Dacre grabs me by the sleeve. Lord Skellen, he says, wants a word with you, Kenner. What to do? Off I go. Tawny Owl sitting behind a table, feet up, whacking his knout against his bootleg, and, without beating about the bush, asks me if I'm the Joanna Selborne who was mixed up in the disappearance of the ship, the Southern Star. I tells him nothing was ever proved. He bursts out laughing. I like people you can't pin anything on, he says. Then he asks if my HSP, hypersensory perception, I mean, is innate. When I says I, his mood darkens, and he says, I thought that talent of yours would come in useful with sorcerers, but first you have to deal with another mysterious personage.
Is the witness certain Coroner Skellen used those exact words?
Oh, I am. I'm a psionic, ain't I?
Please continue.
Our conversation was interrupted by a messenger, Dusty from the road. He clearly hadn't spared his horse. He had urgent tidings for Tawny Owl, and Dacre Siliphant says, as we were heading to our quarters, that he felt in his water that the messenger's tidings would shove us in the saddle before evening came. And he was right, Your Honour. Even before anyone had thought of dinner, half the Hansa were saddled up. I got off that time. They took Tilikrada, the elf. I was content, for after those few days on the road, my arse ached like buggery. And to make matters worse, my monthly had just started. Will the witness please refrain from picturesque descriptions of her intimate complaints and keep to the subject? When did the witness learn the identity of the mysterious personage Coroner Skellen mentioned? I'll tell you directly. But there has to be some order, don't there? For everything's getting so mixed up, we won't ever untangle it. The ones who'd saddled their mounts in such haste before dinner raced from Rockhane to Malhoun and brought back some teenage lad. Niklar was angry with himself. So angry, he felt like weeping. If only he'd heeded the warnings given him by prudent folk. If only he'd remembered his proverbs, or at least the fable about the rook that couldn't keep its trap shut. If only he'd done what was to be done and returned home to jealousy. But, oh no, excited by the adventure, proud to be in possession of a fine steed, feeling the pleasant weight of coins in his purse, Niklar couldn't resist showing off. Rather than going straight home to jealousy, he rode to Malhoun, where he had loads of pals, including several maids to whom he made advances. In Malhoun he strutted around like a gander in spring, kicked up a rumpus, cavorted, showed his horse off around the courtyard, and stood rounds in the inn, tossing money on the counter with a look and bearing of, if not a prince by blood, then at least a count. And talked. Talked about what had happened 4 days ago in jealousy. He talked, constantly offering new versions, adding new information, confabulating, and ultimately lying through his teeth, which didn't bother his audience in the least. The inn's regulars, both locals and travellers, listened eagerly, and Niklar went on, pretending to be well informed, and placing himself ever oftener at the centre of the confabulated events. On the third evening, his own tongue landed him in trouble. A deathly hush fell at the sight of the people entering the inn, and in that hush, the clank of spurs, the rattle of metal buckles, and the scraping of scabbards sounded like a foreboding bell tolling misfortune from the top of a belfry. Niklar was not even given the chance to try playing the hero. He was seized and escorted from the inn so fast he only managed to touch the floor with his heels about 3 times. His pals, who only the previous day, when he was paying for their drinks, had declared their undying friendship, were now practically sticking their heads under the tables, as though incredible marvels were occurring or naked women were dancing there. Even the deputy Shire Reeve, who was present in the inn, turned to face the wall and didn't breathe a word. Niklar didn't breathe a word either, not asking who, what, or why. Terror turned his tongue into a stiff, dry board. They put him on his horse and ordered him to ride. For several hours. Then there was a fort with a palisade and a tower. The courtyard was full of noisy, swaggering, well-armed mercenaries. And a chamber. And in the chamber were 3 men. A commander and 2 subordinates, it was immediately obvious. The commander, short with blackish hair and richly attired, was sober in his speech and admirably courteous. Niklar listened with mouth agape as the commander apologised to him for the trouble and inconvenience and assured him he would suffer no harm. But he was not to be deceived. The men reminded him too much of Bonhart. That observation turned out to be astonishingly accurate, for they were interested in Bonhart. Niklar should have expected that, for, after all, it was his wagging tongue that had landed him in this quandary. When prompted, he began to talk. He was warned to speak the truth and not embellish it. He was warned courteously, but sternly and emphatically, and the one doing the warning, the richly attired one, played all the while with a metal-tipped knout, and his eyes were dark and evil. Niklar, the son of the coffin-maker from Jealousy, told the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, about how on the morning of the 9th of September in the village of Jealousy, Bonhart, a bounty hunter,
had wiped out the gang of rats, sparing the life of only one bandit, the youngest, the one they called Volker. He told them how the whole of jealousy had gathered to watch Bonhart torment and thrash his captive, but the folk were sorely disappointed, for Bonhart, astonishingly, did not kill or even torture Volker. He did no more than what a normal fellow does to his wife on returning home from the tavern on Saturday evening. Just gave her a kicking, slapped her a few times, and nothing more. The richly attired gentleman with the knout said nothing, and Nicola told them how Bonhart had sawn the heads off the slaughtered rats before Volker's eyes, and plucked the golden earrings set with gemstones from those heads like raisins from a bun. How Volker, tied to the hitching post, screamed and puked on seeing it. He told how afterwards Bonhart had buckled a collar around Volker's neck, like you would a bitch dog, and dragged her by it to the Chimera's head inn. And then, said the lad, constantly licking his lips, the general and Bonhart called for ale, for he was sweating something awful, and his throat was dry. And after that, he cried that he had a fancy to give someone a good horse, and a whole 5 florins. That's what he said. Those were his very words. So I came forward at once, not waiting for anyone else to be quicker, for I wanted awful to have a horse and a little coin of my own. The old man gives me nothing, for he drinks whatever he makes on the coffins. So I comes forward and asks which horse, no doubt one of the rats's, can I take? And his lordship Bonhart looks at me till shivers ran through me and says, don't he, that the only thing I can take is a kick up the backside, for other things have to be earned. What to do? Don't look a gift horse in the mouth, says the proverb. Well, rats's horses were standing at the etching post, in particular that black mare of Volker's, a horse of rare beauty. So I bows and asks, what must I do to earn the gift? And Mr. Bonhart says that I must ride to Clermont, stopping off in Fano on the way, on the horse of my choosing. He must have known I had my eye on the black mare, for he forbade me from taking her. So I takes a chestnut with a white patch.
Less about horses' coats, Stefan Skellen reprimanded dryly, and more hard facts. Tell us what Bonhart charged you to do.
His lordship Bonhart wrote some missives and ordered me to hide them secure. He charged me to ride to Fano and Clermont, and there to hand over the letters to the indicated persons.
Letters? What was in them?
How should I know, gentle lord? Reading don't come easy to me, and the letters were sealed with Mr. Bonhart's signet.
But for whom were the letters, do you recall?
Oh, indeed I do. Mr. Bonhart ordered me to repeat it 10 times, so I wouldn't forget. I got where I was to go without erring, and handed over the missives as instructed. They praised me for an able lad, and that honourable merchant even gave me a dinar.
To whom did you deliver the letters? Speak plainly.
The first missive was for Master Esterhazy, a swordsmith and armourer from Fano, and the second was for the Honourable Uvenagel, a merchant from Clermont.
Did they open the letters in your presence? Perhaps one of them said something as you read. Rack your brains, lad.
I cannot recall. I didn't mark it then, and now I can't seem to remember.
Mun? Ola?
Skellen nodded at the adjutants without raising his voice at all.
Take the lad into the courtyard, drop his breeches, and give him 30 solid lashes with a knout.
I remember, the boy yelled. He's come back to me.
Nothing works on the memory.
Tawny Owl grinned, like nuts and honey, or a knout hovering over the arse. Talk.
When Hoovenagel read the missive in Clermont, there was another gentleman there, a little chap, a veritable halfling. Mr. Hoovenagel said to him, he said they'd written that soon there might be sport in the Flea Pit, the like of which the world had never seen. That's what he said.
You aren't making this up.
I swear on my mother's grave. Don't have them flog me, gentle lord. Have mercy.
Well, well, get up. Don't dribble on my boots. Here's a dinar.
1,000 thanks. My lord,
I said, don't dribble on my boots.
Ola, Mun, do you understand anything of this? What does a Flea Pit have in common with
Bear Pit?
Boreas Mun suddenly said.
Not Flea Pit. Bear Pit.
Oi! The boy yelled. That's what he said. Just as though you'd been there, gentle lord.
A bear pit and sport.
Ola Harsheim hit one fist against the other. It's an agreed code. Nothing too elaborate. It's easy. Sport, bear baiting, is a warning about a pursuit or a manhunt.
Bonnart was warning them to flee. But from whom? From us?
Who knows? Said Tawny Owl pensively. Who knows?
We shall have to send men to Clermont, and to Fano also. You take care of that, Ola. Give the squads their orders. Now, listen, my lad.
Yes, sir, gentle lord?
When you left Jealousy with Bonnart's letters, he was still there, I understand. And making ready to leave? Was he in haste? Did he say, perhaps, whither he was headed?
He did not, and neither could he make ready. He'd had his raiment, which was awful blood-spattered, cleaned and laundered, so he was only in a blouse and hose, but girt with a sword, though I think he was hastening to leave. Why, he had thrashed the rats and sawed them's heads off for the bounty, so he needs must ride and claim it. And why he'd captured that Falker, too, to deliver her alive to someone. Why, that's his profession, ain't it?
This Falker, did you have a good look at her? Why are you cackling, you ass?
Oh, gentle lord, have a good look at her. I'll say I did, every detail.
This robe, Bonhart repeated.
And there was something in his voice that made Ciri cringe involuntarily. But defiance immediately got the better of her.
No!
She didn't see the fist. She didn't even catch sight of its movement. She saw stars. The ground swayed, then shot from under her feet and suddenly thumped painfully against her hip. Her cheek and ear burned like fire. She realized she had not been punched, but struck with an open palm. He stood over her and brought his clenched fist towards her face. She saw the heavy, skull-shaped signet, which a moment earlier had stung her face like a hornet.
You owe me one front tooth, he said icily. So, the next time I hear the word no from you, I'll knock two out right away. Get undressed.
She stood up unsteadily and began to unfasten buckles and buttons with shaking hands. The villagers present in the Chimera's head murmured, coughed, and goggled. The widow Gulu, the alewife, bent down behind the counter, pretending to be looking for something.
Strip off everything to the last rag.
They aren't here, she thought, undressing, and staring blankly at the floor. There's no one here, and I'm not here either.
Legs apart.
I'm not here at all. What is about to happen won't touch me at all. Not at all, not a bit.
Bonhart laughed. You flatter yourself, I think. I must dispel those illusions. I'm undressing you, little idiot, to check you haven't concealed any magical talismans, charms, or amulets about your person, not to enjoy your wretched nakedness. Don't start imagining the devil knows what. You're a skinny kid, as flat as a pancake and as ugly as the seven sins. Even if the urge was strong, I'd sooner top a turkey.
He walked over, spread her clothing around with the tip of his boot, and sized it up.
I said everything. Earrings, rings, necklace, bracelet.
He gathered up her jewelry meticulously. He kicked her tunic with the blue fox fur collar, gloves, coloured scarves, and belt with silver chains into the corner.
You won't parade around like a parrot or a half-elf from a whorehouse now. You can put on the rest of those rags. And what are you lot staring at? Gulu, bring some provender. I'm hungry. And you, fatso, see how my vestments are coming on. I am the elder man here. How convenient, Bonhart drawled.
And the elder man of Jealousy seemed to grow slimmer under his gaze.
If anything has been damaged in the laundry, I shall take measures against you as a public servant. Off to the washhouse. The rest of you, get out. And you, pipsqueak, why are you still standing here? You have the letters, the horses saddled, so smartly to the highway and be gone. And remember, should you fail, lose the letters or mix up the addresses, I shall find you and cut you up so fine your own mother wouldn't recognize you.
I'm flying, my lord, I'm flying.
That day, Ciri pursed her lips. He beat me twice more, once with his fist and once with a knout.
Then he lost the urge. He just sat and stared at me without a word. His eyes were somehow like those of a fish. Without eyebrows, without eyelashes. Somehow like watery orbs with a black core sunk into each one. He stared hard at me and said nothing. That terrified me more than being beaten. I didn't know what he was plotting.
Visigotha remained silent. Mice scampered around the chamber.
He kept asking me who I was, but I said nothing. Just like when the trappers caught me in Korath Desert. This time, too, I fled deep into myself, inside, if you know what I mean. The trappers said I was a doll then, and I was. A wooden doll, insensitive and lifeless. I was somehow looking down from above at everything that was being done to that doll. So what if they were hitting me? So what if they were kicking me, putting a collar on me like a dog? For it wasn't me. It wasn't me at all. Do you understand?
I do. Visigotha nodded. I do understand, Ciri.
Then, Your Honour, it was our turn. The turn of our group. Narrated Saker took command over us, and they also assigned Boreas Mun a tracker to us. Boreas Mun, illustrious tribunal, could track a fish in water, they say. That's how good he was. One time, they say, Boreas Mun, the witness will refrain from digressions. Beg pardon? I get it. I mean, they ordered us to ride to Fano at all speed. It was the morning of the 16th of September.
Niratin Saker and Boreas Mun rode at the head, and behind them, side by side, Cabernic Turon and Cyprian Fripp the younger, then Kenna Selborne and Chloe Stitz, and finally Andres Vierney and Didi Vargas. The latter two were singing a new and popular soldier song, sponsored and endorsed by the Ministry of War. Even among soldier songs, it stood out by the horrifying paucity of its rhymes and alarming lack of respect for grammatical rules. It was entitled At War, since all the verses, and there were over 40 of them, began with those words. At war, things can get quite rough. Someone gets their head chopped off. You come back from a drinking bout to see a cove with his guts hanging out. Kenna softly whistled along. She was pleased to be among companions she had come to know well on the long journey from Aetolia to Rocaine. After her conversation with Tawny Owl, she had expected a random assignment to be tagged onto a squad made up of Brigden and Harsheim's men. Till Ekrada had been assigned to a squad like that, but the elf knew most of his new comrades, and they knew him. They rode at a walk, though Dacre Siliphant had ordered them to race at full speed, but they were professionals. They had galloped, kicking up dust, while they could still be seen from the fort. Then they'd slowed down. Tiring horses out and reckless gallops were good for tyros and amateurs, and haste, of course, only comes in useful for catching fleas. Chloe Stitz, the professional thief from Imlach, told Kenna about her erstwhile work with Coroner Stefan Skellen. Cabernic Turon and Fripp the Younger reined in their horses and listened, often looking back.
I know him well. I've served under him several times.
Chloe stammered a little, aware of the suggestive nature of her words, but immediately laughed freely and carelessly.
I've also served under his command, she snorted. No, Kenna, don't worry. None of those demands from Tawny Owl. He didn't force himself on me. I looked for the opportunity and found it. But to be clear, I'll say this. You won't gain his protection by doing that.
I'm not planning anything of the kind. Kenna pouted, looking provocatively at the lewd smiles of Turon and Fripp. I won't be looking for an opportunity, but I'm not worried either. I'm not alarmed by any old thing, and certainly not by a cock.
Now it's all you talk about, Boreas Mun said, reining back his dun stallion and waiting for Kenna and Chloe to catch up with him. We aren't riding off to fight with our cocks, ladies, he added, continuing to ride beside the young women. Bonnar, let me tell you, has few equals with the sword. I'll be glad if it turns out there's no squabble or vendetta between him and Mr. Skellen, and that everything blows over. But I don't get it, Andres Vierney admitted from the rear. Apparently, we were to track down some sorcerer. That's why they gave us a psionic, this here Kenner, wasn't it? Now, though, there's talk about some Bonnard and a girl.
Bonnard, the bounty hunter, Boreas Munn said, had a compact with Mr. Skellen and let him down. Though he promised Mr. Skellen he'd kill that girl, he let her live.
No doubt someone's paying more for her alive than Tony Owl would for her dead.
Chloe Stitz shrugged. That's what bounty hunters are like. Don't go looking for honour among them.
Bonnard is different,
Fripp the Younger, looking back, retorted.
Bonnard never breaks his word,
making it all the stranger that he suddenly started.
And why, Kenner asked, is that lass so prized? The one that was to be killed, but wasn't.
What business is he of ours?
Boreas Munn grimaced. We have our orders, and Mr. Skellen has the right to demand his due. Bonnard was meant to have stuck Falca and didn't. Mr. Skellen has the right to demand that he accounts for it.
This Bonnard, Chloe Stitz repeated with conviction, means to get more money for her alive than dead. There's your whole mystery.
The Lord Coroner, Boreas Munn said, thought the same at first, that Bonnard had promised to supply Falca alive for the sake of amusement and slow torture to a baron from Giso who was determined to punish the rat's gang. But it turned out not to be true. No one knows who Bonnard is keeping Falca alive for, but it certainly ain't that baron.
Mr. Bonnard?
The fat yelderman of jealousy lumbered into the tavern, puffing and panting.
Mr. Bonnard, there are armed men in the village, riding horses.
What a sensation.
Bonnard wiped his plate with some bread.
Now, if they were riding monkeys, that would be remarkable. How many?
Four.
And where are my vestments?
Barely laundered. They haven't dried.
A pox on you. I'll have to greet our guests in my halls. But in truth, the quality of such a greeting suits that of the guests.
He adjusted the belt and sword fastened over his hose, tucked the straps of his hose into his boot tops, and tugged the chain attached to Ciri's collar.
On your feet, little rat.
When he led her out onto the porch, the four horsemen were already nearing the tavern. It was clear that they had ridden long over trackless terrain and through bad weather. Their clothing, harnesses and horses were flecked with crusted-on dust and mud. There were four of them, but they were leading a riderless horse. At the sight of it, Ciri felt herself suddenly growing hot, though the day was very cool. It was her own, still bearing her trappings and saddle, and a browband, a gift from Missel. The horsemen were among those who had killed Hotspurn. They stopped outside the tavern. One, probably the leader, rode up and raised his marten fur kalpak to Bonnard. He was swarthy and had a thin black moustache on his upper lip, like a line drawn in charcoal. His upper lip, Ciri noticed, curled every now and then. The tick meant he looked enraged the whole time. Perhaps he really was furious.
Greetings, Mr. Bonnard.
Greetings, Mr. Imbra. Greetings, gentlemen.
Bonnard unhurriedly fastened Ciri's chain onto a hook on a post.
Excuse my unmentionables, but I wasn't expecting you. A long road behind you, my, my. You've come all the way to Ebbing from Giso. And how is the Honourable Baron? In good health?
Fit as a fiddle, the swarthy man replied indifferently, wrinkling his upper lip again. But there's no time to spend on idle chatter. We're in a hurry.
I?
Bonnard hauled up his belt and hose.
I'm not holding you back.
News has reached us that you slaughtered the rats.
That is true.
And in accordance with your promise to the Baron,
the swarthy man continued to pretend he could not see Ciri on the porch,
you took Falca alive.
I'd say that that is also true.
You were lucky where we were not.
The swarthy man glanced at their own.
Very well. We'll take the wench and head homeward. Rupert, Stavro, take her. Not so fast, Imbra.
Bonnard raised a hand.
You aren't taking anyone, and for the simple reason that I won't give her to you. I've changed my mind. I'm keeping the girl.
The swarthy man called Imbra leaned over in the saddle, hawked and spat impressively far, almost to the steps of the porch.
But you promised his lordship the Baron.
I did, but I've changed my mind.
What?
Do my ears deceive me? The state of your ears, Imbra, is not my concern.
You stayed 3 days at the castle. You guzzled and gorged for 3 days on the promises given to his lordship. The best wine from his cellar, roast peacock, venison, forcemeat, carp in cream. You slept like a king in a feather bed for 3 nights, and now you've changed your mind?
Bonnard said nothing, maintaining an expression of indifference and boredom. Imbra clenched his teeth in order to suppress the twitching of his lips.
You know, Bonnard, that we can take her from you by force.
Bonnard's face, until that moment bored and amused, hardened instantly.
Just try. There are 4 of you and 1 of me. And me in my hose at that. But I don't have to don breeches to deal with scoundrels like you.
Imbra spat again, jerked his reins, and turned his horse around.
The devil take it, Bonnard. What's happened to you? You've always been renowned as a reliable, honest professional. Once given, you keep your word unfailingly. And now it turns out your word isn't worth shit. And since a man is judged by his words, then it turns out that you're a... If the talk is of words...
Bonnard interrupted coldly, resting his hands on his belt buckle.
Then take heed, Imbra, that you don't let too coarse a word slip out by accident. For it might hurt when I shove it back down your throat.
You are bold against 4. But will your boldness suffice against 14? For the Baron of Cassadei will not let this insult slide.
I tell you what I'll do with your baron, but a crowd forms, and in it are women and children. So I shall merely tell you that in some 10 days I shall stop in Clermont. Whomsoever wishes to pursue a right, avenge an insult, or take Falca from me, let them come to Clermont.
I shall be there.
I shall be waiting. Now, be off with you.
They feared him. They feared him terribly. I could feel the fear seeping from them.
Kelpie whinnied loudly, jerking her head.
There were 4 of them, armed to the teeth, and 1 of him, in darned long johns and a ragged old blouse with 2 short sleeves. He would have been ridiculous were he not so terrible.
Visigotha remained silent, narrowing his eyes, which were watering from the wind. They were standing on a knoll, rising above the Periplut marshes, not far from the spot where, 2 weeks earlier, the old man had found Ciri. The wind flattened the reeds and ruffled the water on the marshes.
One of the 4, Ciri continued, letting her mare enter the water and drink, had a small crossbow by his saddle, and his hand stretched out towards that crossbow. I could almost hear his thoughts and feel his terror. Will I manage to cock it, and loose it, and what will happen if I miss? Bonhart also saw that crossbow on that hand. He heard the same thoughts, I'm sure, and I'm sure the horseman wouldn't have been quick enough.
Kelpie raised her head, snorted and jingled the rings of her curb bit.
I was understanding better and better into whose hands I'd fallen. But I still couldn't understand his motives. I'd heard their conversation and remembered what Hotspurn had said before, that the Baron of Cassadei wanted me alive and Bonhart had promised him that. And then he changed his mind. Why? Did he want to hand me over to somebody else who would pay more? Had he worked out who I really was and meant to turn me over to the Nilfgaardians? We set off from the village before nightfall. He let me ride Kelpie, but he tied my hands and held me by the chain fixed to the collar the whole time. The whole time. And we rode almost without stopping, a whole night and day. I thought I'd die of exhaustion, but he showed no tiredness at all. He isn't a man. He's the devil incarnate.
Where did he take you?
To a little town called Fano.
When we entered Fano, illustrious tribunal, it was already gloomy, murky as you please. Only the 16th of September, in truth, but the day was overcast and cold as hell. You'd have said it was November. We didn't have to search long for the armourer's workshop, for it was the largest farmstead in the entire town. And what's more, the ringing of hammers forging iron relentlessly sounded from it. Naratin Saker, Master Scribe, you write his name in vain, for I don't recall if I said, but Naratin is dead now, killed in a village called Unicorn.
Please do not instruct the clerk. Continue with your testimony.
Naratin knocked at the gate. He politely said who we were and what was our business and asked politely to be heard. We were admitted. The swordsmith's workshop was a fine building, virtually a stronghold, with a palisade of pine timbers, towers of oaken planks, and inside, planed larch on the walls.
The court is not interested in architectural details. Let the witness get to the point. Prior to that, however, please repeat the swordsmith's name for the records.
Esther Harzy, illustrious tribunal. Esther Harzy of Fano.
The swordsmith, Esther Harzy, looked long at Boreo's man, unhurriedly answering the question posed to him.
Perhaps Bonnard was here, he finally said, fiddling with the bone whistle hanging around his neck. And perhaps he wasn't. Who knows? This gentlefolk is a workshop where we forge swords. We shall answer any questions concerning swords eagerly, swiftly, elegantly, and at length. But I see no reason to answer questions concerning our guests or customers. Kenna pulled a kerchief from her sleeve and pretended to wipe her nose.
A reason can be found, said Naratin Seker. You may find one, Mr. Esterhazy, or I may. Would you choose?
In spite of the semblance of effeminacy, Naratin's face could become hard and his voice menacing. But the swordsmith only snorted, continuing to toy with the whistle.
Choose between a bribe and a threat?
I would not. I consider the former and the latter worth only of being spat on.
Just one tiny piece of information, Boreas Munn said, clearing his throat. Is that so much? We've known each other long, Mr. Esterhazy, and Coroner Skellen's name is known to you.
It is, the swordsmith cut in. It is indeed.
The misdemeanours and exploits with which that name is associated are also known to us. But we are in Ebbing, an autonomous and self-governing kingdom, only seemingly, perhaps, but nonetheless. Thus we shall tell you nothing. Continue on your way. As a consolation, we'll pledge to you that if in a week or a month someone asks about you, they will hear just as little.
But Mr. Esterhazy, must I make it clearer? Prithee, get out of here.
Chloe Stitz hissed furiously. Fripp and Vargas's hands crept towards their hilts, and Andres Vieni laid his fist on the warhammer hanging at his thigh. Naratin Seker did not move, and his face did not even quiver. Kenner saw that his eye never left the bone whistle. Before they entered, Boreas Munn had warned them that the sound of the whistle was the signal for bodyguards, consummate men-at-arms, called quality controllers, who were waiting concealed in the swordsmith's workshop. But having foreseen everything, Naratin and Boreas had planned their next move. They had a trump up their sleeves. Kenna Selborne, psionic. Kenna had already probed the swordsmith's mind, had gently pricked him with impulses and cautiously pervaded the tangle of his thoughts. Now she was ready. Pressing a kerchief to her nose, there always existed the danger of a nosebleed, she forced her way into his brain with a throbbing and a command. Esterhazy began to choke, flushed, and grasped the table he was sitting behind with both hands, as though he feared it would float away to distant lands, along with a sheaf of invoices, the inkwell and the paperweight, depicting a Nereid cavorting with two Tritons at once.
Keep calm, Kenna commanded. It's nothing. Nothing's the matter. You would simply like to tell us what we wish to know, for you know what interests us, and the words are positively bursting forth from you. So, go on. Begin. You will see that you only need speak, and the humming in your head, the roaring in your temples, and the stabbing in your ears will cease, and the spasm in your jaw will also subside.
Vonart,
Esterhazy said hoarsely, opening his mouth more often than would be expected from the syllabic articulation.
Was here 4 days ago, on the 12th of September. He had a wench with him, he called Falka. I was expecting his visit for 2 days. Earlier, a letter from him had been delivered.
A trickle of blood seeped from his left nostril.
Speak, Kenna ordered. Speak. Tell us everything.
You can see what a relief it will be.
The swordsmith Esterhazy scrutinized Ciri with curiosity, without getting up from the oaken table.
It's for her,
he guessed, tapping a penholder against the paperweight depicting the weird group.
The sword you requested in the letter, right, Barnard? Well, let's examine it then. Let's see if it agrees with what you wrote. 5 feet 9 inches in height? And such she is. 112 pounds in weight? Well, we'd have given her less than 112, but that's a minor detail. A hand, you wrote, which a number 5 glove would fit. Show me your hand, honourable maiden. Well, and that agrees too.
With me, everything always agrees, Bonnard said dryly. Do you have any decent iron for her?
In my firm, Esterhazy answered proudly, no other iron than decent is manufactured or offered. I understood it was to be a sword for combat, not for gala decoration.
Ah, yes, you wrote that.
Naturally, a weapon will be found for this maid without any difficulty. Swords of 38 inches suit such a height and weight standard manufacture. With that light build and small hand, she needs a mini bastard, with a hilt lengthened to 9 inches and a pommel. We could also suggest an elven tall dagger or Zirakanian sabre, or alternatively, a light Viroledanian.
Show me the wares, Esterhazy.
Hot-tempered, are we? Well, come this way, come this way.
Hey, Bonnard, what the devil is this?
Why are you pulling her on a leash?
Keep your snotty nose out of this, Esterhazy. Don't stick it where it doesn't belong, for you're liable to get it caught somewhere.
Esterhazy, toying with the whistle hanging around his neck, looked at the hunter without fear or respect, though he had to crane his neck a good deal. Bonnard twisted his moustache and cleared his throat.
I, he said, a little more quietly, though still malevolently, don't meddle in your business or affairs. Does it surprise you that I demand reciprocity?
Bonnard? The swordsmith did not even flicker an eyelid. When you leave my home and courtyard, when you close my gate behind you, then I shall respect your privacy, the secrecy of your affairs, the specifics of your profession, and I shall not meddle in them, be certain. But in my home, I shall not allow you to abuse human dignity. Do you understand me? Outside my gate, you may drag the wench behind a horse if you wish. In my home, you will remove that collar. Forthwith. Bonnard reached for the collar and unfastened it, unable to resist a tug which almost brought Ciri to her knees. Esterhazy, pretending he hadn't seen it, let the whistle slip from his fingers.
That's better, he said dryly. Let's go.
They crossed a small passage into another slightly smaller courtyard, adjoining the rear of the smithy, with one side opening out onto an orchard. There was a long table there, beneath a canopy resting on carved posts, where servants were just finishing laying out some swords. Esterhazy gestured for Bonnard and Ciri to walk up to the array.
This is what I offer.
They approached. Here, Esterhazy pointed to a long row of swords on the table, we have my wares.
All the blades were forged here. You can see the horseshoe, my punch mark. Prices fall in the range of 5 to 9 florins since they're standard. These, though, lying here, are only assembled and finished by us. The blades are generally imported. Their origin can be told from the punches. The ones from Mahakam have crossed hammers stamped on them. Those from Povis, a crown or a horse's head. And those from Viroleda, a sun and the famous workshop's inscription. Prices start at 10 florins.
And where do they end?
That varies. Oh, this one, for example, is an exquisite Viroledanian.
Esterhazy took up a sword from the table, gave a salute with it, and then moved to a fencing position, dexterously twisting his hand and forearm in a complicated sequence called an angelica.
This one is 15. Antique workmanship, a collector's blade, clearly made to order. The motif, chiselled on the ricasso, shows the weapon was intended for a woman.
He turned the sword over, hand held in tierce, pointing the blade flat at them. As on all Viroleda blades, the traditional inscription,
draw me not without reason, sheathe me not without honour.
Ha! They still chisel such inscriptions in Viroleda. Throughout the wide world, these blades have been drawn by blackguards and elves.
Throughout the wide world, honour has gone way down in price, for it's an unprofitable commodity.
Don't talk so much, Esterhazy. Give her that sword. Let her try it for size. Take the blade, girl.
Ciri grasped the sword lightly, feeling the lizard-skin hilt cling firmly to her palm and the weight of the blade urging her arm to wield and thrust.
It's a mini-bastard, Esterhazy reminded her, needlessly.
She knew how to use the long hilt with three fingers on the pommel. Bonart took two steps backward into the courtyard. He drew his sword from the scabbard and whirled it around until it hissed.
Have at me, he said to Ciri. Kill me. You have a sword and you have the opportunity. You have the chance. Make use of it, for I shan't soon give you a second. Have you lost your mind? Quiet, Esterhazy.
She beguiled him with a glance to one side and a deceptive twitch of her shoulder, and struck like lightning with a flat sinistra. The blade clanged so powerfully against the parry that Ciri staggered and had to leap to one side, banging her hip against the table with the swords. She involuntarily loosened her grip on the weapon, trying to regain her balance, knowing that at that moment he could have killed her without the slightest difficulty, had he so wished.
You have lost your minds, Esterhazy said.
His voice raised. The whistle was in his hand again. The servants and craftsmen looked on in stupefaction.
Put the iron aside.
Bonart did not take his eyes off Ciri, utterly ignoring the swordsmith.
Aside, I said, or I'll hack off your hand.
She obeyed after a moment's hesitation. Bonart smiled ghoulishly.
I know who you are, you viper, but I'll make you reveal it yourself. By word or deed, I'll make you reveal who you are, and then I'll kill you.
Esterhazy hissed as though wounded.
That sword,
Bonart didn't even glance at him,
was too hefty for you, and because of it you were too slow. You were as slow as a pregnant snail. Esterhazy, what you gave her was too heavy by at least 4 ounces.
The swordsmith was pale. His eyes ran from her to him, from him to her, and his face was strangely altered. At last he beckoned a servant and issued an order in hushed tones.
I've something, he said slowly, which ought to satisfy you, Bonart. Why then didn't you show it to me at once? Snarled the hunter. I wrote that I wanted something extraordinary. Perhaps you thought I can't afford a better sword.
I know what you can afford, Esterhazy said with emphasis.
I've known that for no little time.
But why didn't I show you this one right away?
I had no way of knowing who you would bring here, on a leash with a collar around her neck. I couldn't guess who the sword was meant for and what it was to serve. Now I do.
The servant had returned, bearing an oblong box. Come closer, girl, Esterhazy said softly. Look. Ciri approached and looked and sighed audibly. She unsheathed the sword with a deft movement. The fire from the hearth flared blindingly on the blade's waverly outlined edge, glowed red in the openwork of the ricasso.
This is it, said Ciri. As you've probably guessed. Hold it if you wish, but beware, it's sharper than a razor. You feel how the hilt sticks to your hand.
It's made from the skin of a flatfish, which has a venomous spine on its tail.
A ray?
I guess.
That fish has tiny teeth in its skin, so the hilt doesn't slide in the hand, even when it sweats. Look what's etched on the blade.
Visagotta leaned over and examined it, squinting.
An elven mandala, he said soon after, raising his head. The so-called Blathan Kirm, or Garland of Destiny. Stylized oak blossom, bridewort, and broom flowers. A tower being struck by lightning, a symbol of chaos and destruction for the old races. And above the tower?
A swallow,
Ciri completed.
Zirael, my name.
Indeed, a fine thing, said Bonart finally. Gnomish had the work, that's clear at once. Only the gnomes forged such dark iron. Only the gnomes used undulating blades, and only they open-worked their blades to reduce the weight. Come clean, Esterhazy. Is it a replica?
No, the swordsmith snapped. It's original. A genuine Gnomish Gwaihir. The blade is more than 200 years old. The finishing, naturally, is much more recent, but I wouldn't call it a replica. The gnomes of Tir Tochair made it to my order, following ancient techniques, methods, and patterns.
Damn it. It may be too dear for me after all. How much do you wish for this blade?
Esterhazy was silent for some time. His face was inscrutable.
I shall give it to her for nothing, Bonnard, he finally said in a hushed voice. As a gift, so that what is to come about will come about. Thank you, said Bonnard, visibly astonished. Thank you, Esterhazy. A kingly gift, kingly indeed. I accept. I am indebted to you. You are not.
The sword is for her, not for you. Come here, girl with a collar on her neck. Examine the marks etched into the blade. You don't understand them, naturally, but I shall explain them to you. Look, the line delineated by destiny is winding, but leads to this tower. Towards annihilation. Towards the destruction of established values of the established order. But there, above the tower, do you see? A swallow, the symbol of hope. Take this sword, and may what is to come about come about. Ciri cautiously extended a hand and gently stroked the dark blade, its edge gleaming like a mirror.
Take it, Esterhazy said slowly,
looking at Ciri with eyes wide open.
Take it. Hold it, girl. Take it.
No, Bonnard suddenly barked, leaping up, seizing Ciri by the arm and shoving her suddenly and forcefully.
Away!
Ciri fell onto her knees, the gravel of the courtyard painfully pricking her hands, which she had to spread to keep her balance. Bonnard slammed the box shut.
Not yet, he snarled. Not today. The time is not yet come.
Most evidently. Esterhazy nodded calmly, looking him in the eyes.
Aye, it most evidently hasn't come yet.
Pity. It was of little avail, illustrious tribunal, reading that swordsmith's thoughts. We were there on the 16th of September, 3 days before the full moon. And while we were returning from Farno to Rockane, a patrol caught us up. Ola Harsheim and 7 horse. Mr. Harsheim ordered us to race as fast as we could to reach the rest of the unit. For the day before, the 15th of September, there had been a massacre in Clermont. I suppose I don't need to tell you. The illustrious tribunal doubtlessly knows about the massacre in Clermont.
Please testify without worrying what the tribunal knows.
Bonnard was a day ahead of us. He brought Falca to Clermont on the 15th of September.
Clermont?
Visigotta nodded.
I know that town. Where did he take you?
To a large house in the town square, with arcades and columns at the entrance. It was obvious at once that a wealthy man lived there. The chamber's walls were draped with sumptuous tapestries and splendid wall hangings depicting religious and hunting scenes and idylls featuring disrobed women. The furniture gleamed with inlays and brass fittings, and one sank ankle deep into the carpets. Ciri had no time to note the details, though, for Bonnard walked swiftly, dragging her by the chain.
Greetings, Hovenhagel.
Lit by the spectrum of colours cast by a stained glass window, his back to a hunting tapestry, stood a man of impressive corpulence, attired in a caftan dripping with gold and a fur-lined coat trimmed with caracul pelts. Although in the prime of his manhood, he had a bald pate and pendulous jowls like those of a great bulldog.
Greetings, Leo, he said. And you, lady? That's no lady.
Bonnard showed him the chain and collar.
No need to welcome her. Politeness costs nothing. Nothing but time.
Bonnard tugged the chain, walked up and unceremoniously patted the fat man's belly.
You've put on a good deal, he remarked.
By my troth, Huvadagel, were you to stand in the way, it would be easier to jump over you than walk around.
Prosperity, Huvadagel explained jovially, shaking his cheeks. Greetings to you, greetings, Leo. It is wonderful to host you, for I am most inordinate joyful today. My business affairs are going so admirably well that I feel like touching wood. The tills are ringing. Only today, may this serve as an example, a captain in the Nilfgaardian reserve horse, the quartermaster responsible for supplying gear to the front, flogged me 6,000 military bows, which I shall retail with a tenfold profit to hunters, poachers, brigands, elves, and divers other freedom fighters. I also bought a castle from a local marquis. Why the hell do you need a castle? I must live regally. Getting back to my business affairs, one deal is quite simply thanks to you, Leo. A seemingly hopeless debtor paid me back, quite literally a moment ago. His hands were shaking as he paid me. The fellow saw you and thought, I know what he thought. Did you receive my letter? I did. Huvenoggle flopped down heavily, knocking the table with his belly and making the carafes and goblets on it ring. And I've prepared everything. Haven't you seen the handbills? The rabble must have torn them down. Folk are already heading for the theatre. The tills are ringing. Sit you down, Leo. There's time. Let's talk. Enjoy some wine.
I don't want your wine. It's army issue, no doubt, stolen from Nilfgaardian transports.
You must be jesting. It's est from Toussaint. The grapes picked when our gracious emperor, Emir, was a mere nipper. Sitting in his cradle. It was a good year, for wine. Cheers, Leo.
Bonnard silently raised a toasting goblet. Huvenagel smacked his lips, examining Ciri extremely critically.
So, this is the doe-eyed nymph, he said at last. Who is to guarantee the sport promised in your epistle? I know that Windsor Imbra is already nearing the town, and has with him several decent cutthroats, and a few local swordsmen have seen the bills.
Have you ever been disappointed by my wares, Huvenagel?
Never, 'tis true, but neither have I had anything from you for a good while.
I work more seldom than in the past. I'm thinking about retiring entirely.
Capital is needed for that, from which to support oneself. I might have a way. Will you listen?
Only for want of other amusement.
Bonnard pulled a chair closer with his foot and made Ciri sit down.
Have you ever thought of heading north? To Sintra, to the slopes, or across the Yeruga? Do you know that anyone who moves there and chooses to settle on captured territory is guaranteed a plot of 8 ox gangs by the Empire and freedom from tax for a decade?
I, replied the hunter calmly, I'm not cut out to be a farmer. I couldn't till the soil or breed cattle. I'm too sensitive. The sight of dung or worms makes me want to puke.
Me too!
Huvenagel shook his jowls.
The only thing I can tolerate in the whole of agriculture is distilling spirits. The rest is repugnant. They say agriculture is the basis of economics and guarantees prosperity. I consider it, however, contemptible and humiliating that something stinking of manure should determine my prosperity. I've taken some steps in that regard. One need not till the soil, Bonnard. One need not raise cattle on it. It's sufficient to own it. If one has enough of it, one can extract decent profits from it. One can, believe me, live a life of ease. Yes, I've taken certain steps in that regard. Hence, indeed, my question about a trip northwards. For you see, Bonnard, I would have work for you there. Permanent, well-paid, undemanding. And just right for a sensitive fellow like you. No dung, no worms.
I'm prepared to listen. Without committing to anything, naturally.
From the plots which the Emperor guarantees the settlers, one can, with a bit of enterprise and a little seed capital, put together quite a decent latifundium.
I understand.
The hunter chewed his moustache.
I understand what you're getting at. I already see what steps you're taking regarding your own prosperity. Do you see no difficulties?
Oh, I do. Of two kinds. Firstly, one has to find hired hands who, pretending to be settlers, will travel north to receive the land from the distributing officers and take over the plots, formally for themselves, but in practice for me. But I shall set about finding them. The second of the difficulties concerns you. I'm all ears. Some of the hired hands will take over the land and then be disinclined to give it up. They will forget about the agreement and the money they have taken. You wouldn't believe, Bonhart, how deeply fraud, wickedness, and low motives are ingrained in human nature. I would. I will need someone to convince the dishonest that dishonesty doesn't pay, that it's punishable, and you could take care of that. It sounds excellent. It is. I have experience. I have already conducted rackets of this kind. Following the formal inclusion of Ebbing into the Empire when plots were distributed, and later when the Enclosure Act came into force, owing to that, Claremont, this charming little town, is on my land, and thus belongs to me. The entire area belongs to me. Far, far away to the mist-shrouded horizon. It's all mine. 300 ox gangs, all told. That's over 6,000 acres. Imperial acres, not peasant ones. 24,000 roods. Oh, lawless empire close to downfall, Bonhart recited scornfully. An empire where everybody who steals has to fall. Its weakness lies in self-interest and self-seeking. Its power and strength lie in it. Huvenagel shook his cheeks. You, Bonhart, confuse thievery with private enterprise. Only too often, admitted the bounty hunter detachedly. What do you say to this partnership, then? Isn't it too early to be dividing up that land in the north? Perhaps, to be certain, we should wait until Nilfgaard wins the war. To be certain? Don't jest. The result of the war is a foregone conclusion. Wars are won with money. The Empire has it, and the Nordlings don't. Bonhart cleared his throat meaningfully. While we're on the subject of money...
Ah, yes.
Huvenagel rummaged in the documents lying on the table.
Here's a bank check for 100 florins. Here is the deed of contract for the transfer of obligations, on the strength of which I shall receive the reward for the bandits' heads from the Van Hagens of Giso. Sign here. Thank you. You are also owed a percentage of the takings from the extravaganza, but the accounts have not yet been closed. The tills still are ringing. There is great interest, Leo. Great indeed. People in my town are awfully troubled by boredom and despondency.
He broke off and looked at Ciri.
I sincerely hope you aren't mistaken with regard to this person, that she will furnish us with wholesome amusement and be willing to cooperate for the sake of our joint profit.
There won't be any profit for her. Bonhart eyed up Ciri indifferently. She knows that. Huvenagel grimaced and snorted.
It's no good, no bloody good that she knows. She ought not to know. What's the matter with you, Leo? And if she's not willing to be sporting, if she turns out to be spitefully uncompliant, what then?
The expression on Bonhart's face didn't change.
Then, he said, we'll unleash your mastiffs into the arena. They've always been compliant where sport's concerned, as I recall.
Ciri was silent for a long time, rubbing her disfigured cheek.
I was beginning to understand, she finally said. I was beginning to realize what they wanted to do with me. I gathered myself. I was determined to escape at the first opportunity. I was prepared for any risk. But they didn't give me the chance. They were guarding me too well.
Risugota said nothing.
They dragged me downstairs. The guests of that fat Huvenagel were waiting there. More eccentrics. Where do all these grotesque, odd fish come from, Visigota?
They breed. Natural selection.
The first of the men was short and chubby, more resembling a halfling than a human, and was even dressed like a halfling, modestly, pleasantly, neatly, and in pastel colours. The second man, though no longer young, had the outfit and bearing of a soldier and a sword at his side. Silver embroidery depicting a dragon with bat-like wings sparkled on the shoulder of his black jerkin. The woman was fair-haired and skinny, with a slightly hooked nose and thin lips. Her pistachio-coloured gown had a plunging neckline, which wasn't very well advised. There wasn't much cleavage to show, apart from wrinkled and parchment-dry skin covered in a thick layer of rouge and white lead powder.
"Her noble ladyship the Marchioness de Nemynth Oivar," Hoovernagel said. "Lord Declan Ross F. Melchlan, captain in the Nilfgaardian Reserve Horse of His Mighty Emperorship